This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, All in Your Head, Mental Illness Representation in Modern Young Adult Fiction.
And this week, we are delighted to welcome Kayla Ankrum onto the show. Hello, Kayla!
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. We're so glad you could join us. It's in a rare position where both Madeleine and I have both read your book, The Wicked King. Usually it's one of us has read the book and said, oh, we must have this person on the show, but both of us have read it and we both like, yeah, we have to have Kayla on. So thank you so much.
I've actually known Kayla for a while from Tumblr, and it took ages for me to get a copy of The Wicked King, because obviously Kayla is in America and I'm in Britain, so it took ages to get a copy, and then I read it and I was like, Jules, you've got to read this, Jules. And then the next thing I knew, Jules was like, yeah, I've talked to Kayla, so we're going to get her on the show. And I was like, oh, I'm very, very happy. So welcome, Kayla. It's so great to finally have you here.
I'm super excited. It's been like 4 years. We are like ancient Tumblr friends. It's been a while.
We've been equals for quite some time. So for all of our wonderful listeners, Kayla, will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. So I am 27. I wrote The Wicker King when I was 23, when I was in college. I live in Chicago. I am neurodivergent myself, because I know this is the topic. I have ADHD, catatonic depression, and a lot of issues with like executive dysfunction. I am friends with a lot of other people who are neurodivergent, so this is kind of my wheelhouse. And in my personal life, because I know people like to hear what authors like to read versus what they write, I write a lot of young adult fiction, but I tend to read a lot of middle grade fiction for some reason. Like, I'm really into that kind of like plucky 12-year-old with no money and no property and nothing, going out to fight adults with their tiny fists and their wits, and that's it.
Brilliant. Cool.
Is there anything else in particular that you think?
Well, it's a bit funny here. Tell us a bit about The Wicked King. Well, tell our readers or listeners a bit about The Wicked King.
Certainly. So The Wicked King is a contemporary thriller. I tend to write books that are like heavy contemporary with like a little dribble of sci-fi, a little dribble of, you know, other things. It is a story about these two best friends, one of which has kind of like a devolving mental illness thing that he's going through, and the other that has like a very physical illness that's presenting as a mental illness kind of perspective, very like unreliable narrator. And it's a story about how one of the kids has like a hallucinatory disorder that develops into this really elaborate world that only he can see. And his best friend, August, has to help him like accomplish different things inside of that world, kind of like a champion to kind of help him, even though he can't see what he's doing. And it's kind of like a story that balances fantasy with like real life consequences of their lifestyle and their choices and how the world kind of rewards their behavior, for lack of a better word.
And it's a really unusual story in the sense, as you say, balances almost those two threads, that fantasy layer or magical realism layer, and the alter, the uber real layer as well, which is, you know, rings very, very true to life. But you chose a mixed media format for it as well, didn't you?
I did, yes. Actually, the story of this is kind of funny. I started it when I was 22, finished when I was 23, graduated from college, and got in contact with the agent that I had at the time. And she was kind of like loosey-goosey on whether to sign me, because my book was really weird and the format was really weird and everything. And I think the book, Night Film, it's an adult novel about crime that also has a multimedia aspect, it came out. And she was like, oh, this book would be really cool with some multimedia aspects. If you put in some multimedia aspects, then I will sign you. And then she's like, okay, you get a week. You have a week to do this. And if you can do it, then oh I'll sign God. You. And I was like, you know what, bitch? I will do this. So I like scurried over to my nearby Starbucks and like stayed there for like 6 hours a day. And I did probably about 80% of the multimedia in the book is from 2 years ago when I took up that challenge and I was like, you know what? You want it? I'll give it to you. And actually, when you open the, like, in the first cover, there's like a police report and you see like the main character's little face and everything. And it's got like fingerprints on the bottom from when he was booked. Those are my fingerprints because nobody at Macmillan was willing to like, so like, you know, we'll just keep these and not say anything about it. So yeah, so that was a combination of me and then our design department, who is spectacular, came up with the thing with the book where it fades from like light to dark as August's mental illness, you know, becomes more elaborate. They just did that on their own, and then they were like, oh, we did something to the, you know, the arc or whatever. If you hate it, we'll take it away. And they sent it to me, and I was like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like, what do you mean you'll take it away? So that's how that...
No, I'm just going to say, that was a fantastic decision, because I think it really highlights the steady progression that you show in the book of not only the situation, which is becoming steadily more dire, but one of the things which is happening, and again I don't want to give too many spoilers, is that one of these kids is kind of losing his sight in a way. Mm. And as this kind of happens, the two kids are thrown into this very blind kind of situation. And so having that physically manifest on the pages, I just thought it was brilliant. I really, really liked it.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. I'll let the design team know.
You should. I loved the way that you used Dia, because not only did it really add to that kind of contemporary, it actually managed to create an even stronger sense of kind of the fantastical elements that were happening as well. And you do leave it quite open-ended in some ways, which I felt was actually also very, very real. Realistic, the way that they approach this fantasy and this magic, and the way that they kind of want to believe in it as well, and what that says about them. I just think it was really cleverly done, and it really touched on a lot of very real and important things for me.
Thank you. I feel a lot of the like circumstances surrounding, and I'm going to try not to say anything that can't be found by searching the book or reading like the summary, but a lot of the things that happen in regards to their situation with neglect and their situation with their mental illness and how the various adults in their life have failed them has been things that I've seen in my own like real life. I read all of my reviews just, you know, because I use them to improve the quality of my work. And there were a lot of people in the early ages of when the book first came out who were like, oh, this circumstance is very unrealistic. I don't understand why their school nurse isn't like, you immediately need help. Or I don't understand why their parents aren't there. Or, I don't understand why they're getting disciplined instead of getting real help. And it's like I know people who have completely been failed by the system in every way possible. And there were like tons and tons of, and these reviews always like broke my fucking heart. But all of these moms who would read the book and be like, this is very wrong. What happened to them was wrong. And I don't like this book because it is wrong that they didn't get the kind of help that they needed. And like, I know people who would have died to have a mom or an adult in their life tell them that the circumstances that they were living through was wrong. Like, it always made me cry to read those. I was like, thank you for existing. It doesn't matter if you don't like this book. It doesn't matter. As long as you're there to understand that this is something that happens and should never be happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think I read it with the newly minted Dragons and Tea book group, which is run by Melanie and Amy, who are two of my book blogger friends. And I was like, oh, the great Madeline recommended this to me, and I can read it with all my book buddies. And I was commenting all the way through, and the further we got into the book, I was like, where are all the fucking adults, dude? Seriously. I think I might have actually put that up in one of the threads. Like, where are the fucking adults?
You, within the acknowledgements at the end of the book, which I read with great interest, and something which is very obvious throughout, is that this is coming from a, I don't want to make presumptions here, but this is coming from a very personal place for you, which is why I think you've handled the subject so realistically and so carefully as well, because I think that you've come at it with a level of understanding which means that it feels very real. And you're right that one of the main criticisms that in the reviews or the things that I've seen is people say, well, it's unrealistic, where were the adults? And I think that actually that's what is constantly happening every time we review trauma cases or particularly cases of abuse which are linked in with mental health. It has been an issue of where are the adults. And it's a little bit different in the UK, I think. I'm not saying it's better or worse. I think it's a slightly different situation because, of course, we have a different healthcare system.
Yeah.
And also depending on kind of what level of school you're at or what kind of school you're at, you are going to have more care than others. But I do remember in my school, I went to a very privileged school. I went to several very privileged schools, which had a lot of wealth attached to them. You know, we had a lot of a very, very professional staff. There was a kid there who went to the nurse's station, and unfortunately, the receptionist could act as a nurse. And this kid went in and said, "I'm, you know, having chest pains, or I'm feeling very unwell." And the nurse said, "Okay, well, just go and lie down." And it was only later that one of the other professional nurses came in and says, "Oh my God, no, that kid's on the watch list. He was having a heart attack."
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it went unnoticed, and it was only because this other nurse came in and said, "Hold on, we've specifically been told to watch out for this kid," that mm-hmm. it was caught in time and that he didn't die.
Yeah.
And you know, you just think even in the most privileged situations, kids and young people are so often overlooked, and they're not listened to, and they're put in positions where also the people who are meant to be helping them don't have the resources to do so, don't have the time, don't have the money, don't have the experience. So I just think that, yeah, actually the book felt very accurate to me, because I thought, yeah, I can believe this is happening. I can totally believe this is happening, since historically and until very recently most mental health issues have been overlooked unless you are part of a very select group of individuals or you happen to be very lucky in who you go to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think one of the things that was really important to me in regards to like the portrayal of the main character and his struggles was the slow progression of his misbehavior during school.
Yeah.
And like how, cause I mean, there's such a huge thing where a lot of kids act out for secondary reasons. But a lot of like school administration will be like, "Oh, that's just the bad kid. That's just, you know, I don't know why your grades are bad. I don't know why you won't stop doing this during class. Like, I don't know." And they're just kind of like, whatever's going on in your life is whatever's going on in your life. We just kind of want you to come to school and sit down quietly and, you know, all of that and stuff. And you're told in the beginning of the book, "Oh, this kid is, he makes decent grades. He's, you know, known for being very fastidious. He's known for being this way." And then like, as the book progresses, you see these, one of the multimedia objects are, like detention slips that he gets. Mm-hmm. And like the more of them he gets, the more like physical and like disruptive his in-class actions are. And it was really like weird and sad to me reading about people reading the book who are like, "Oh, why is this kid like doing all this stupid stuff? Like, I don't understand why he's such an idiot. Like, I don't understand why he's so like reckless and ridiculous." And it's like, if there was a kid in your real life who was doing things like this and whose behavior changed so rapidly, you would fail them.
Yeah,
because you wouldn't see these as warning signs, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I taught karate, which is not the same as school, obviously, but for about 15 years. And one of the things, I worked as the child protection officer for the Federation as well. And mm-hmm. one of the things that you're taught really early on is that you watch for gradations of behavior. And when you see a persistent pattern like that, that's when you start to intervene. You know, obviously there's training for it. So mm-hmm. it made me really sad when so many people were saying, you know, it's just not realistic. Why is he getting into trouble? And it's like, because, you know, why isn't he talking to people? And it's like, well, his experience in life is that there is no one there to help him, that adults are not caregivers and protectors, that they're not people you go to with problems. His experience is that he can only count on himself and his friends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's not just that. It's not just that adults are not protectors. It's that adults make things worse. You know, on the occasions where he has tried to rely on adults, he's been put in positions or he's seen where they're worse off. And so that's a very powerful message to give. And the fact that the school then ultimately kind of reinforced that by failing to recognize that his bad behavior, that this change in, you know, in his nature is a reflection of something bad, something worse happening, and they fail to recognize that. They don't see these symptoms. They just try and they try and, you know, punish the symptoms without looking at what the illness is. So yeah, anyway, sorry, we've gone on a bit of a tangent here, but before we go on, I feel like we need to actually frame the episode and actually sort of mention what we're actually going to be talking about this episode, just in case our listeners haven't clocked on
yet. Yeah, that was so, 20 minutes of us like getting to a point. Oh, we love your book, we're going to explain it back to you now.
So Jules, do you want to go ahead and just sort of give an idea of what we're going to be looking at?
Yeah, so as the title suggested, we're looking at mental illness portrayals in young adult fiction. And from there, obviously, how this is both beneficial and potentially damaging, depending on where those portrayals sort of lead you. And I think a good place to start is we define what we mean by mental illness. Now, Madeline's already said we're not really discussing neurodivergency in this episode because it's slightly too big for us to fit in alongside.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognise that mental illness is all part of neurodivergence.
Yeah.
You know, there's different kind of ends of the spectrum. So this episode, we're not going to be looking at things like ADHD, dyslexia. We're going to put those to the side just for now because we'd like to do an episode on those individually. So we're going to be concentrating more on what I would refer to as behavioural, if that makes sense, or not behavioral, then you know what I mean. So we're going to be looking at anxiety and depression, and then at sort of the other kind of side of the spectrum of mental illness, things like schizophrenia,
borderline personality disorder, bipolar.
Yeah, things like that. So that's what we're going to be concentrating on today. And it's a big topic.
It is a huge topic, and it's worth saying that neither Madeline nor I, well, unless Madeline's really been holding out on me, have got a psychology degree of any description.
Well, actually, I'll have you know that this morning. as with Kayla has already shared that she suffers from depression. Both Jules and I are also coming from this from a level of experience. On a personal level, I suffer from depression and anxiety. And Jules, I'll let you talk about yourself. I'm not going to...
It's a difficult one to characterise for me because I have temporal lobe epilepsy, and one of the symptoms of temporal lobe epilepsy is a generalised sort of malaise and depression. But I find that symptom doesn't particularly affect me, not much anymore. But I have suffered from episodes of what I would call reactionary depression and anxiety over various traumatic things in the past. So I'm coming from a position of understanding what it's like to exist under that low cloud on the mountain where you can't really see anything else. But it's not somewhere that I end up spending lots of periods of time, very fortunately for me.
There is also the, and if you don't want to talk about this, then that's fair, but the hallucinogenic.
Oh, no, I will talk about that a little bit later because that was quite interesting. And, you know, Kayla might find the weird workings of my brain quite interesting too.
So that's what we're going to be talking about today. So I actually want to get the ball rolling. We've talked about Kayla's book and we're going to come back to it. But I want to talk about Six of Crows. And the reason I want to talk about Six of Crows is, first of all, it does have a lot of neurodivergence, but we're not talking about that. But I particularly want to look at Kaz Brekker in Six of Crows by Leah Bardugo. And in particular, because Kaz Brekker is suffering from PTSD, which has developed, which has caused him to develop a very physical symptom of that. And I really like the way it was portrayed. So for those who haven't read it, this is a slight spoiler, but Kaz Brekker cannot stand to be touched by other people. He cannot stand the sensation of human touch. It physically drives him, it makes him physically nauseous, and it's because it causes flashbacks, and it triggers the sensation, which is to do with the trauma that he faced when he was younger. And I felt that this was incredibly important because sexual abuse is something which is looked at in the books and is touched on about, you know, the trauma related to sexual abuse. But in this case, whilst you would have thought having, you know, something to do with touch was going to be to do with sexual abuse, his trauma is nothing related to that at all. But it is surrounded by sensation. And I thought that it was one of the most interesting and unique ways of looking at PTSD. Because I think that PTSD, when it's represented in fiction, is very often looked at in a very narrow kind of way. And a lot of people misunderstand what it is. And a lot of people also misunderstand what constitutes as PTSD. You say PTSD and people think, right, soldiers coming back from war zones. But actually, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, can have been caused by a big number of different things and different experiences and can manifest in a lot of different ways. So I was really interested to see that in a book for young adults.
I think it's interesting because it's in a fantasy book as well. And all too often in fantasy, there's an inciting incident where someone's brother or someone's friend is killed in front of them. And every so often when it's convenient in the plot of the book, that character will have a flashback or will suddenly overreact to somebody talking to them or reaching out to them. But it's never really properly characterized as, you know, that this is actually really a problem for them, because it's just as conveniently got over when it's necessary for the plot. So to do it properly and actually have it become a real problem for this character's life was quite a brave choice, I think.
I think it was, and it's a constant. That's the important thing for me, is that it is a constant. And it's a constant which is being handled. Kaz has kind of figured out a way of dealing with it. And it's not necessarily a very healthy way. He literally just goes, right, I'm never touching anyone ever again. Which you can understand, but there's a level of impracticality, specifically in obviously the kind of work that he does. He ends up getting into quite a lot of scuffles, and inevitably he's forced to kind of relive this trauma over and over again. Because he's not actually been allowed or been given the platform to deal with it. And I really, really, again, I really, really like it. And it's kind of, it links in with the way I reacted to book 5 of Harry Potter, for instance, which is that initially when, as a kid, I read book 5 of Harry Potter, I'm like, wow, why is Harry so shouty? And everyone, you know, is always talking about, oh, that's the book that Harry Potter suddenly goes through puberty and gets very shouty. And I'm like, no, that's the book after Harry has been through something horrifically traumatic has been tortured, has watched a friend of his, a pupil, be murdered in front of him, has been toyed and almost been killed by the man who murdered his parents, and is then discovered that a caretaker, someone who was looking after him, was trying to work against him all along, and has then been left to kind of rot on his own all summer. Yeah. In an abusive household.
You're absolutely right. I'm going to bring you back from there a bit because I feel we're getting on a tangent.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. So, yeah, okay. PTSD, that's an important one to look at. Let's move back to something which I think is probably a lot more common. Not that PTSD is uncommon, but it's been getting a lot more press and probably deserves to get a lot more press than it does already. And that's depression, and how accurate portrayals of that in books, particularly young adult fiction, are really important.
Yeah. Taylor?
Yes.
Sorry, just making sure you're still there. Sorry.
Yeah. I didn't want to say anything to interrupt the general flow, but...
That's fine. Definitely interrupt, because it's no offence to Madeline, but she has a few topics, and so do I, where we will go on for absolutely ages. So yeah. just pull us back.
We need to be stopped.
Okay, here's a statement. Mental health. Okay, plot idea. Right. Mental health issues in books can be polarizing. And this is because either people don't want to read about them, or those who are happy to read about them feel that the way they're portrayed don't reflect their own personal experiences. So my theory is that mental illness portrayals in books can be polarizing simply because they fall into the same trap as sort of LGBTQ plus representation in books, whereby the example is being made to represent the entire spectrum when what it really is an example of one part of it.
Yeah.
I think in general, it's more of a priority to make sure that when you're writing mental illness to portray it as accurately as possible. One of the things that I think a lot of writers who decide to take on that topic struggle with is what is fantastical, what is romanticized, what is, what aspects of whatever disorder they're interested in portraying are manipulated in such a way to showcase a more interesting and innovative storytelling aspect versus what is generally traditional, and whether it's gritty or whether it's not. And one of the things that I was extraordinarily staunch about, and I'm not going to say that anyone asked me to change any aspects, but just very, very, very strict about, was the textbook accurate portrayals of mental illness in The Wicker King, even at the detriment of generalized storytelling, for the specific reason that if somebody who is within the age of onset, because the book occurs in the age of onset, was experiencing anything that they were reading, they could know that it is not okay and to seek help for it. And one of the things that I think a lot of people had criticism about was the abruptness of some of the treatments. And it was very important for me to make sure that even though, it may not necessarily create that kind of dramatic and flowing, oh my gosh, figuring out what's going on and everything like that, that it actually is treated in this specific way, or this is actually what they do to help with blank, or this is how psychologists who are talking to people who are having delusions will talk to them about it to gain their trust, to make sure that they can actually do medical progress with their therapy. I wanted to make sure that was accurate as possible, because in my youth, I read a book about OCD that was exactly as textbook accurate, and one of my friends figured out that she had OCD from reading the book, and that just seemed really, really important. More important than whether or not people should read it or not, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, I know, I agree with that. You actually pull quite a good bit of misdirection in The Wicker King as well, because, spoiler alert, people, but I've tried not to do anything too major, but we come in with the assumption that actually the mentally ill one of the two lads is Jack. And it turns out that his illness is nothing really to do with that. It exhibits faintly mental ill type symptoms. But behind that, you've got August, who is slowly crashing and burning. And very few people can actually see that that's what's happening, because everyone's looking at the shinier, more obvious mental illness in Jack, or the apparent one. And that seems to me quite true to life, because people don't, you know, particularly for people who don't realise they're actually suffering from depression, can't understand or aren't willing to admit it to themselves yet. It's just not necessarily seen.
Yeah, I think for this specific book, I did like a ridiculous amount of research to make sure that things were like accurate. I think I spent like 3 months just reading like case studies and, you know, speaking to people who advocate for children who go through neglect, and speaking to people who have dealt with kids dealing with issues with intense codependency and depression and anxiety and everything like that. And then on top of that, for Jack's specific illness, first of all, it's not particularly common. So I read literally everything there was to write about it, because there's only probably cumulatively about 60 pages of medical text about it just out there. And then by the grace of God, I managed to contact somebody who wrote one of the case studies and get like a, you know, first person perspective of what it was like to write this case study about this disorder. Because it was very, very important to me to be able to accurately portray a physical hallucinatory disorder that has absolutely no, like, psychosis aspects of it. It is, I think, one of only two that you can have it and not have any, like, mental illness issues whatsoever. You're just being regular, just seeing stuff, and that's it. And, like, the juxtaposition between my main character, August, and his struggles with anxiety and depression and issues with codependency, and what eventually blows out into basically being full-blown borderline personality disorder. And Jack, who's seeing stuff and reacting to everything that's happening, like very, very neurotypical. He's only sad when he sees scary stuff. He's only upset when August is upset. He is very, like, clear about what's going on. He knows that he's seeing things that aren't real. He's not necessarily, like, going, you know, his issue isn't, like, blossoming into psychosis. He's actually just going blind. So his issue is with not being able to see, because the only thing he's seeing is the hallucinations. Yeah. Balanced with August actually breaking down, crying, like having issues with like various aspects of self-harm, male representation of anorexia, like just all of these other things that are like real true representations of burgeoning psychosis, next to somebody who's just like chilling, but, you know, having this visual thing. And there's a part in the book where August is at his absolute worst and Jack is completely blind, and he's kind of, the way he's talking to August is kind of indicative of the fact that he's significantly more okay. And having that perfect balance between having Jack's physical disorder develop at the same pace of August's psychological disorder was really, really difficult. But there's this thing that you can do where if you decide to reread the book with the understanding that August is an unreliable narrator, and you just like don't pay attention to any of his, I'm fine, Jack's the one with the problem, everything's going okay, I can handle this, you just like ignore all of that and just focus on Jack. Watching Jack watch August was probably the hardest thing to write I have ever done in my career, to make it so that if you ignore him, you can see his friend experiencing like secondary concern about his issues, even though he's the narrator.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very multi-layered book, definitely.
I think one of the interesting things, of course, is that when August is kind of confronted about what's happening with him, he's totally blind to it as well. Oddly enough, it is this kind of, it's all about going blind. And Jack is going physically blind, but August has completely developed, is blind to what is going on with him, you know, with his own life. Mm-hmm. And he's just, he's completely can't understand or can't believe that he's in a bad state, and that he's in just as bad a state as Jack is. It just, it doesn't even occur to him. And it is really, really interesting because they develop this very codependent relationship, which is something that you see a lot of in young kids who are suffering from poor mental health. Mm-hmm. Because it's this sense of only you understand me, or only I can help you, because adults are not good enough. And you know, even from a personal level, you know, I've experienced this, I've seen this, of two young kids who are depressed, who are propping each other up, because they just cannot get, or they feel like they can't get what they need from adults. And I think one of the most important things, and as you've said, you try to write this as accurately as possible, but one of the most important things you did is that when real professionals do come into it, and when it comes to actually treating these two boys, it's nothing like how we stigmatize and show the treatment of mental health in fiction otherwise. These are professionals who actually do know what they're talking about, and they do know what they're doing, and they actually do ultimately help. But before they could get to what they needed to get this help, they only had each other. So of course this codependency developed. It's very interesting, and it's very real.
I suppose the thing is obviously that not everybody experiences depression in exactly the same way, and not everyone will exhibit the full gamut of symptoms. It may be a bit of a pick and mix affair. Let's take a look at The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness, which again does deal with mental illness as well. So without going into the fantasy aspect of of that book, which to be fair actually happens off page.
It does. It's kind of just in the background, isn't it?
It's in the background. But I think it's worth mentioning that I think, from what I understand, that he does a reasonably good job of portraying OCD. He obviously does a fairly good job of portraying the later stages of dementia, which, you know, we haven't actually talked about at all and probably don't have the scope to do so now. And again, talks about anorexia and recovering from anorexia. And again, you have a bunch of kids there who are kind of relying on each other, even while they actually all have their own issues. And I suppose this is a thing with Jack and August, is the fact that you cannot be everything for one other person, just as they cannot be everything for you, because it's too much pressure to expect of anyone. It's certainly too much pressure to expect of a couple of teenagers who are still kind of working out who they are.
Yeah. I think one of the things that was brilliant about The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness is that he also recognised that it's not just the treatment. There is an aftermath as well. And when you have a mental health issue, it's not something which is necessarily going to go away. So anorexia is looked at, but it's post-recovery, if that makes sense. And it's about saying that actually, even post-recovery, there is the potential to fall back into the illness. It's not something that just goes away. It is something that marks these characters and will stay with them forever, something that they're kind of going to have to be conscious of for the rest of their life, and that they're going to have to be, you know, careful of, and there will be bad days. And one of the really important things that I loved about The Rest of Us Just Live Here is the fact that one of these characters does have obsessive compulsive disorder and suffers from depression as well. And this character actually makes an effort to suddenly say, I think I need to go back to see a therapist, which was brilliant, because I think very often, and again, it's understandable in certain circumstances, you know, about saying, no, I don't want to see a therapist. So in the case of, you know, August and Jack, no, they don't want to see a professional, because adults have been consistently poor and unhelpful, and even damaging in their lives. So why on earth would they rely on an adult to help them. Why would they think an adult ever could help them? Whereas in The Rest of Us Just Live Here, he has had past with a therapist. It has been beneficial. And it's a big step for him to turn around and say, things are so bad again that I think I need to see one. And there is just this chapter, which I really, really liked. And again, it you also get a similar chapter, without giving too many spoilers, in The Wicker King, where it's just a conversation between the character and their doctor or their therapist. Mm-hmm. And it's this to and fro, which is incredibly insightful. And for me, it was very moving. I cried in both scenes when I read The Wicker King and it was the therapy scene. And also when I was reading The Rest of Us Just Live Here and it was the therapy scene. And I think that portraying that is important. And if you can do it accurately, you can actually do a lot of good.
Mm-hmm. I actually want to say something about the portrayal of mental health institutions in young adult fiction.
Yeah.
My book is set in 2002, and first of all, around that era, like, a bunch of mental health institutions lost their funding and closed, so there aren't, like, a lot of them in the area in which the book is set, and a lot of the things that happen in like, mental health institutions, specifically ones that deal with, like, criminal behavior and people who just are generally need to be observed for a set period of time, who can check themselves in and check themselves out, which is, like, two completely different levels of like, intensity. A lot of people have a lot of issues with just the portrayal of institutions in general, just across the board, not just me, just everything about how they're always portrayed as being, like, really scary places where bad, worse things happen to you, where, you know, all of the staff is really mean and you're not allowed any freedom. And, you know, just, like, the experience of being there is triggering and terrible. And absolutely, there have been many, many cases of hospitals that have created that sort of scenario. But I think that it's very important to showcase kind of a little bit about how they can be healing in a lot of cases. Specifically with the one that I wrote, I wanted to keep it, like, time period accurate. So, like, a lot of the things that are going on that aren't, like, super, like, oh, this is the best hospital ever, are, like, very clearly, like, budget cuts. Like, we can't have staff doing this because no one has enough money to cover that. Or,
yeah.
You know, this is where we're telling you both, we're sending you in two different places, but there was only one in the area for, like, 8 years during when the book was set, within, like, 120-mile radius. So we'll put one of you on this wing and another one of you on this wing and just work really hard to make sure you never see each other.
Yeah.
So, like, things like that, or, like, the mental health care professionals coming in, almost like a merry-go-round of them, just because there were so many people who were like, okay, there is one place that my degree has value. I can be somebody who's attached to maybe two or three clients, and I'll just come in and leave. Like, that was a huge thing at the era. And then, you know, the experience of finding somebody who actually understands how to talk to you, to get through to you, and finding somebody who cares about the intimate feelings that you have and is very gentle with them, and finding somebody who is rooting for long-term care instead of just, you know, you're getting cared for while you're here and good luck when you leave. Like, you know, the intimate kind of aspect of finding someone who actually gets you enough that you can begin to improve yourself and begin to work on yourself was something that is very important to the portrayal of those kind of institutions as well.
I also like that there were elements where it was not universal, in that different people kind of wanted different things, because you do have a nurse who kind of organizes them for them to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was actually very accurate, because it also meant that you had this very human level as well, which is that some people were like, actually, I don't think this is what this boy needs, because they interact with them on different kind of levels and from different perspectives.
Yeah.
And it did highlight the fact that nurses will have a different relationship to a patient than a doctor will. And maybe the insight is right, maybe it's wrong, but both are very important. So And yeah, I think it is obviously very important to recognize that there have been abuses in the system, just as there are abuses in any system where you have someone who is vulnerable, mm-hmm. And someone else who has power against them. So yeah, but I think the problem is that the fact that there have been abuses have painted a lot of the good that people do with all of the bad,
and
which means that people. Sorry.
I was going to say, we're still trying to shake off the Victorian Gothic horror trope of asylums, where you put people that you don't know what to do with.
Yeah, yeah. The problem is that it adds to the stigma, which is that if you have been to, into a mental ward of any kind, then you're broken, there's something wrong with you, there's something scary about you, mm-hmm. that's only where the undesirables go, and if you are the kind of person who goes there, then you're dangerous. Which is the only reason you'd be sent to such an awful and terrifying place, which means that you get people who genuinely do need this medical help, mm-hmm. who can't go there. And it also ends up painting the fact that, you know, we think, oh, someone with schizophrenia, that they must be an axe murderer, they must be terrifying, when actually, statistically, people with schizophrenia are more likely to be victims of abuse than they are to hand out any kind of abuse.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Changing tack slightly, I want to talk about identity and mental health. And it's one of those things where you have mental illness and mental health portrayals in young adult fiction, and they do seem to go quite hand in hand with identity. And I think that's quite telling, in the sense of, as a young adult, that's when you're finally sort of working out who you really are and how you really work as an adult, how you interact with the adult world. You might be discovering that actually your sexuality is not what you thought it was, or not what you've always assumed it was. You might be discovering that, in fact, you're not the gender that was ascribed to you at birth. So there's all these things. It can just be the growing pain, sort of, I'm out on my own now and I don't know how to interact with people in an adult relationship. It can be as simple as that. So all of those things can feed into mental wellness or lack of mental wellness, and it's good to see that reflected well in young adult fiction.
Yeah, I think that there's this kind of, and for lack of a better word, this identity of being quote-unquote okay, and the whole thing of, like, am I okay? Am I not okay? And, like, wanting to always be okay. And, like, regardless of, I think in very early stages of, like, dealing with mental illness, I've had depression from when I was very, very young. So that was something that I always kind of, but it was catatonic depression, which exhibits, like, dissociation. So it wasn't sad. I was just, like, nothingness. And when you have nothing to compare that to, you just kind of accept it. And you're like, whatever, I'm in third grade and I'm outside my body right now. This is fine. Like, you know, I didn't really have the experience of feeling quote unquote normal, and then getting to be maybe like 14 or 15 during the onset for, like, a lot of, you know, those, a lot of anxiety and stuff like that. And then struggle with deciding whether I'm okay or whether I'm not okay, and then having that relief of that mixture of, like, horror and relief of admitting that I'm not okay. I didn't experience a lot of that growing up, but, like, everyone I've ever been friends with has, like, dealt with that.
Yeah.
Where they get to a point and they're just like, wow, I do this thing and I did not know that everybody doesn't do this, basically an accommodation, this thing. And now that I know that I'm the only one who does this thing, what do I do with that information? How does that impact whether or not I love myself? How does that impact how I see my future and whether or not I believe myself is capable of happiness? Whether or not I need to get adults involved, and whether or not that will impact my quality of life. And by quality of life as a teenager, I don't mean, like, general well-being. I mean, like, whether or not you're having fun. So, like, it's very, very different between having fun and being properly treated, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When, you know, a teenager gets to that point and they're just like, all right, I'm having OCD symptoms. Things are not great. I cannot manage this on my own. You know, I'm sliding back in school. My friends are having difficulty relating to me. Like, these are huge problems. Would it be better for me to work really hard on coping mechanisms and you know, accommodations without any medical assistance? Or to bite the bullet and approach an adult about it and risk not being believed, or risk not, you know, receiving the kind of treatment that I want, risk being stigmatized and made an outcast, or risk being punished for exhibiting these behaviors. And that initial step is so terrifying when you're like 15, 16, 13, yeah, however old, that so many teenagers will just kind of sit on it until they get to be like 17 or 18 or 19, when they have slightly more control over, you know, their medical, you know,
yeah,
what they're going to do with it and stuff like that. But in, yeah, that interim, there's like at least a solid 4 years of suffering. And it's just absolutely horrifying to deal with. And I think that it was very important to me to kind of portray that teeter-tottering between, am I okay? Am I okay? You know, because that's the reality for so many teenagers who are growing up right now.
Yeah. I think there's also another aspect as well, which, and this is going to sound so stupid, but the aesthetic of sadness.
Oh, yeah.
That's, yeah.
Which you get this, you know, scenarios where you have this idea that being happy equates to being stupid or shallow, and being sad equates to intelligence and depth and things like that. And again, this sounds so stupid, but it's very real, whereby you have kids who feel sad, or who might even, as a form of kind of, you know, emotional self-harm, put themselves in situations where they feel sad, or even create scenarios where they are victims, because they kind of get addicted to this aesthetic. And it causes massive problems as you grow older, because it can affect your development. It can affect the way in which you interact with other people. And it can affect the way that you view yourself, in which this, in trying to create this image of yourself, you've actually genuinely caused emotional trauma. And it does happen, whereby people end up with depression and you know, post-traumatic stress, because they've purposefully allowed this to happen themselves in trying to chase an ideal that doesn't exist, which is pushed onto us by the media. And I'm in no way saying that it's these kids' fault. You know, there is also a level of responsibility of portraying, of allowing kids to know that it's okay to ask for help.
I think that's
and recovery and things.
That is, yeah, that sort of touches on the idea of success and failure, but at a sort of young adult level, whereby you must have these things in your life to be considered successful and or okay, as Kayla, yeah, said. And therefore, if you somehow fall short of this, you are failing. We're always told that failure is bad. Actually, failure just is a step on the journey, ultimately.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to frustrate you. But the problem is, we're constantly fed this low-level sense of, if we are not achieving what we are told we should be achieving, then we are not human incorrectly, therefore we are broken.
Yeah. Which, yeah, is it's incredibly damaging. And I think, yeah, the real problem comes with the idea that young kids are not given the outlet to actually really recover properly. And also the fact that a lot of the time, the stresses and things that young people go through are looked down upon, when actually, just because they don't have the same reason, like the idea of saying, why are you getting upset about someone laughing at you in class? There are kids out there who are being beaten and abused. You have no right to be upset. And that's just not how emotions work.
Yeah, actually, I want to make an aside for this, because I think it's important to specifically talk about like teenage girls and teenage boys and how they kind of bear the brunt of this topic.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, like, I mean, the whole concept of like emotional teenage girls, and like how, you know, that is such a comedic aspect, or was like a huge comedic aspect for the longest time. It's not like it's very clear that writers, both, you know, for television media and for books, are putting significant and pointed effort into not relying on the stereotype, but like for huge amount of time through like the 70s to probably mid 2000s, like 2008 or so, the archetype of the, you know, whiny, emotional teenage girl was like huge, huge in, you know, both like pity porn type media that's designed just to romanticize and glorify like sadness and tragedy, yeah, and in comedy. And what is actually happening is that teenage girls are getting to an age where, first of all, age of onset, which is affecting both like everyone of every gender, but also experiencing the like tragedy of growing up in a aggressively sexist society in a way that like impacts so many aspects of growing up as a teenage girl or growing up coded as a girl, that is just like not addressed ever in any way, shape, or form, pretty much at all. Yeah. That, you know, if somebody's having a lot of anxieties and their anxieties are focused primarily on the way that they look and their weight and stuff like that's like a social societal issue that's creating a mental health issue, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that's really important to talk about for girls. And then for guys, which is rarely discussed for, I mean, just teenage boys and mental health is just ridiculously underexplored, both in fiction and in real life. They are not getting help at all. And it's just really, really horrible. I'm very like emotionally involved in the concept of this. But a lot of guys will go through the same kind of mental health struggles that the girls around them will go through. But because they're not coded as masculine, they will get no help for it whatsoever. And no support, no nothing. Like anorexia, like extreme like depression that hyper focuses on like sadness and like crying. Yeah. A lot of issues with OCD. They'll be like, oh, he's just very organized. Oh, he's just like a hard ass or whatever.
And it's not even just on a professional level that they won't get help. We literally teach young boys to hold it in and not even to open up to each other. Yeah,
exactly.
So they don't even get the emotional support from each other, from their friends, which is something that girls do. We are relatively supportive. That's something which is glorified in fiction in some respect, you know, the girl kind of friends. But you don't get that with guys. They're literally told not to be vulnerable with anybody except sometimes their romantic partner, which again creates this impossible situation whereby one person is your entire outlet. It's not healthy. The relationship doesn't work. And I just don't think it's any wonder that male suicide rates are so high for young men.
Yeah, it's just isolation and pain. And it's absolutely terrible. And it's one of those things that, like, when there are books about, you know, teenage boys going through mental health journeys, they're so incredibly valuable to that community because, like, reading some of the reviews, not for my work, specifically for Patrick Ness's work, and seeing, like, the, you know, 14, 15-year-old boys being like, I had no idea that anyone else could feel this way.
Yeah.
Like, what a just horrific sentence to have come out of a child's mouth. Like, it's a lot. I could go on a tangent for this, but it's a lot.
No, definitely. Briefly touch on bipolar and in hand in hand with that, with sort of schizophrenic type hallucinations. I just want to mention a book called Bleeding Violet by Dia Rees, which I really enjoyed. It's a fantasy. It's about a girl called Hannah who suffers from bipolar disorder, and she moves to a town called Portero. Portero is not like an ordinary town. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but she, as far as I've read it and understand it, she does have quite an accurate representation of bipolar disorder in this, and she suffers from schizophrenic hallucinations comorbidly with it. But weirdly, this actually helps her, because in this town where there are all these awful monsters that are out to get new people because the town's made a bargain with them, so any incomers like kind of get fed to them unless they manage to get citizenship. The fact that she is already used to seeing the world in a different way to other people and coping with the fact that other people cannot see it the way she does means that she adjusts far better and survives. The book attracted a certain amount of criticism because people felt that that was like magicking a solution onto a mental health problem, but that's not quite how it read to me. The reason I touch on this is because initially, I think perhaps as maybe you intended us to, Kayla, I thought that Jack was experiencing basically schizophrenic hallucinations. And when I was reading it, I ended up messaging Madeline saying, this is giving me a really eerie feeling because this is very much like my temporal lobe epilepsy. Temporal lobe epilepsy affects the parts of your brain that allow you to see reality as other people understand it. So when it's not treated, it can make things quite strange. That's an understatement. So I was reading these descriptions and I'm like, wow, this is almost like taken out of my head from before I was diagnosed with it and treated for it properly. That sort of sense of that there's something extra. There's an extra layer of film painted over reality, and there are strange things there, and I know other people are not seeing what I'm seeing. But what really got me was the rapturous blue and the fact that it actually turned out to be something real. Because the strange thing about temporal lobe epilepsy is that sometimes it will pick up something that is genuinely there, but other people can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a strange resonance, and it is just a physiological thing, as in when my brain's misfiring, it's basically dropping acid by itself.
Yeah, it's for this, I did a little bit of research on schizophrenia, specifically to make sure that I wasn't including aspects of it the disorder that Jack has, to make sure that I would be able to clearly like separate them.
Yeah.
So Jack doesn't have auditory hallucinations. Anything that he talks about seeing is stuff that he's seen like written on walls or has read off the lips of people, and he's like really crisp about, you know, talking about that's how he sees it. And there are other things like this specific disorder is so weird in comparison to other hallucinatory disorders, but it's very, very strict about how you only see things that are nice and good. So like you don't really see a lot of like, you know, horrifying hallucinations. Whereas like with a lot of the other disorders, it's either a balance between like good stuff and bad stuff or like just bad stuff.
Yeah.
With other people who have suffered it. And these are I think there's only like 3 or 4 cases where they've been written about extensively in regards to their experience with it. But one woman used to see like lines of children dressed in beautiful bright colors doing a parade down the street every day at sunset. And then somebody else used to see beautiful silver birds that would like kind of fly at his periphery, and that was it. Or like there was somebody else who would see like miasmas of color, like she was always walking in a rainbow, and that was it. No other like psychosis related to anything but visual and creativity, which is what things have to be being pressed in order to create this disorder. So kind of working really hard to distinguish between the two, because I didn't want to write a book about schizophrenia that wasn't true to the experience of schizophrenia and didn't put in the, wasn't true enough to the experience to be what people who are experiencing that deserve.
Yeah.
In their fiction. I wanted to make sure that, like, you know, because if I'm going to write a book about schizophrenia, you bet your bottom dollar it's going to be crisp. But, you know, with this, I just wanted to hyper-focus on this really specific disorder because it was the perfect template for showcasing somebody who was dealing with actual psychosis versus somebody who's just experiencing this visual, I guess, stimuli.
Mm. Yeah, that was... Okay, not to go on too much because obviously it's a neurodivergency issue, but
yeah.
That's one of the things they have problems with TLE, as in there's a big split as to whether some neurologists actually believe it's real. So that's not very helpful, getting a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And then obviously it sounds to people when you're trying to describe it as if it's some form of schizophrenia, particularly for people who don't really know a lot about schizophrenia as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, so your average GP over here wouldn't necessarily know. And certainly I didn't have a very helpful one to start with, is all I will say.
Yeah, there is in general, a massive misunderstanding of what these conditions mean. Like you say schizophrenia and people immediately go, oh, that's just hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And you're like, there's lots of different forms of schizophrenia. And you might just hear the sound of rain constantly. or, you know, it's not all visual, and it's not all hallucinations. It can also be about, you know, it's about not being able to organize your thoughts as well, and it's just, yeah. And I think the problem is that this all comes down to the way that schizophrenia and other sort of mental health issues have been portrayed in media, probably all thanks very much Victorian Gothic fiction, but the fact that it's been used to vilify characters or to explain behavior. And certainly I think if you go around murdering people, there's something wrong with your brain. You know, that is going to be caused by something that isn't the same as everybody else. But yeah, this relationship between mental sickness and mental illness and cruelty and evilness and things like that is rather damaging, really.
I just want to say something really, because I know we're getting low on time, but I just want to say something really quickly about age of onset, because I feel like when we talk about mental health, we don't really talk about that much, because it's always like, oh, this is happening to me, versus like there being a time where nothing was happening to you and now something is happening to you. Yeah. And about how a lot of teenagers are within that like age of onset range, and how your experiences in regards to specifically mental illness that has to do with like intense psychosis can be something where you trust your experiences because you always could until now, you know, like how huge of an aspect that is to the experience of, you know, mental illnesses. And specifically with August, who he has BPD. He just doesn't know it yet. And it's not in the book because it's something that kind of like is resolved a little bit in my second book. But, the age of onset for that is the age that he is, usually. And there are things that can happen to you that kind of like, not necessarily create it, but like if you had the propensity to get it and then nothing happened to you, you might not actually get it. Versus if something happens to you, it's just like, you have no choice. This is what you got, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing that happens to him is this experience with Jack. And there's no going back. He's just heading towards that. And I think that having discussions about, you know, being okay and then not being okay versus always not being okay and not necessarily wanting to admit that you're not okay is something that, you know, is worth, I guess, respecting.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think we are going to have to call it now. This has been absolutely fantastic. I've really enjoyed your insights. Kayla, before we go, can you sort of just tell our listeners where they can sort of find you on the net and anything else that you've got going on that we can look out for?
Oh, yeah, sure. I am on Twitter, just Kayla Ankrum, or K Ankrum, I should pop up. I'm also on Tumblr. My website is kankrum.com. It's kind of like a author landing site mixed with a Tumblr blog, so you can get both from there. I have another book called The Weight of the Stars coming out March 19th. It's kind of like Interstellar, but from Murph's perspective, and it's like a cute lesbian romance. And let me see, what else?
Have you got an author website or anything like that?
Yes, that's kankrum.com.
Fantastic.
And let me see, is there anything else? No, I think that's it. I think anything else is off the record.
Well, I definitely recommend you guys go and find Kayla online and follow her. She posts some good stuff. Good stuff! and before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have, and it's a little bit weird. Before I get to that one, obviously, if you haven't checked out The Wicked King, Madeline has recommended it as a DD recommendation before, but go and check it out because it's really good.
Yeah, seriously. I think I recommended it the week that I finished reading it. I was like, everybody, please. So yeah, absolutely do go and check that out. That was a past recommendation. So.
Just
but for this week.
That one.
Yeah.
But for this week, it's a film that I watched recently. It's called How to Talk to Girls at Parties. and it is a slightly bizarre speculative fiction affair based on a Neil Gaiman short story. It is it's low budget. They filmed it in like 30 days. It doesn't have a lot of polish, but it's so well acted. It has an amazing script, and it sort of celebrates this three lads basically coming of age, and they start off very laddie at the beginning, as in talking about, you know, getting with girls at parties, etc. They kind of crash and burn, and then they find themselves at another party, which is not what it appears to be at all. And they really learn something about themselves, and it's funny and bittersweet, and it's just an amazing film. Totally go and watch it. I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
I love that you said a little bit bizarre and then Neil Gaiman, and I feel like you only needed one of those things.
Yeah, I was really doubling
down. for me to expect. The moment you said Neil Gaiman, I was like, ah, yes, I understand. I see. Okay, well, thanks for listening, guys. Thanks again for coming on, Kayla.
Yeah, thanks, Kayla.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
We'd love to have you back sometimes. You've got this next book coming out, so if you'd like to come back on the show and talk about that later on, we'd love to have you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Don't feel you have to agree now, obviously.
Yeah. No, genuinely. We're going to get you agreeing on the recording so that we can hold you accountable later. thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.